You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, the top of Ian Durham's list of the biggest physics advances of 2013.
Which is just insane. How do you do that? Just wrapping your head around, how do you make something out of photons? Because photons are the quantum particle of light.
And could our baby universe have been teeming with alien life when it was just 15 million years old?
Well, it was a silicon-based life form, and basically they metabolized sulfuric acid. But there, it was entirely a rock-based life form.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Hello again, and welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that this is the third and final part of our trilogy of podcasts this December, in which, among other things, we're counting down the biggest physics news stories of 2013, as picked out by physicist and FQXI member Ian Durham of St. Anselm College, New Hampshire.
Yes, it's part three. I'm torn between calling it Ian Durham and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Or, a classic here, FQXI Hard 3. FQXI Hard with a Vengeance.
Well, since there are no prisons mentioned in the discussion of his top two items, but there is a lot of violent retribution, let's go with the latter. So, without further ado, here is Ian Durham's choice for the physics advance that just misses out on the top spot. Okay, so now, number two, and we're sort of saying goodbye to something here. So tell us more about that.
Well, I wouldn't say we're saying goodbye to it. We're opening the door and waving.
What a lovely way of thinking about things. You're a much happier, more optimistic person than I am, but explain more.
I don't know. So this year marked officially, it took some debate about whether this actually happened, but Voyager 1 left the solar system. Well, there's some argument that Voyager 2 has also left the solar system, but the point is that we made a decision this year that based on the data we were getting from the Voyager spacecraft, that at least one of them, possibly both of them, were no longer in the solar system, that they had passed outside of the range of where the solar wind meets interstellar space, which is roughly what we define as being the solar system. And that's just amazing, because we have a human, something created by humans, a material thing created by humans. Because obviously we've been broadcasting radio waves into outer space for a century. We now have something that we crafted with our own hands. I mean, heck, it's got a record on it. A gold record with Carl Sagan and stuff talking. This thing is now outside of our solar system. And that is just amazing on so many levels. The other mind-blowing thing about it is that these things are still working.
Right, yes, that's right, yeah.
They were launched when, I was 3 years old, and I no longer have any hair on my head. The little hair I have is gray, and these things are still working, and we're able to communicate with it. And they're so far away, that, and I can't remember the exact number, I believe they're so far away that it's round-trip communication is something like 25 hours or something like that, moving at the speed of light. That's how far away these things are. They're just phenomenally far away.
And just to give you some more stats, so I've got this from New Scientist magazine. It says that Voyager 1 has enough nuclear fuel to keep doing science through to 2025, which is, again, very impressive. And on its current trajectory, the probe should eventually end up within 1.5 light years of a star in Camelopardalis, which is a lovely name, a northern constellation that looks like a cross between a giraffe and a camel.
And what I find interesting, too, is that, you know, we've discovered exoplanets. This was another possibility of putting this on the list, but we've discovered exoplanets floating around out there that are not orbiting a star. They're just kind of rogue exoplanets floating around in interstellar space. And we can see some of them because you know, they give off a dull infrared radiation. But, you know, maybe there's one that we haven't seen, and maybe Voyager will bump into it. Who knows? It'd be kind of interesting.
Right, so there were a couple of other sort of spacey kind of cosmology, planetary sort of stories and results that you might have wanted to mention.
Yes, that didn't make my list. It seems like every other day there's some new result coming back from Mars. Believe me, I don't want to minimize this stuff, but you know, the big thing is they're looking for evidence of life on Mars, and they have sort of incrementally been able to nail down that Mars once had a wet climate, and they found this year building blocks of life, certain molecules that are required for life to actually exist. The reason it didn't make my top five is because, again, it's incremental progress. Come back to me when you find life. That's what or evidence of life, fossilized life.
You want a Martian. That's what you want.
I want a Martian. Right. Yeah, I want a little green man. But the point is what they're looking for now is they're looking for something that is incontrovertible, that this is evidence that life either currently exists in a microbial form or did exist at one time on Mars. And when they find that, then it'll make my top five.
And what about the Planck data release? So the Planck satellite gave out its first release of kind of cosmological findings. So, you know, there was a lot of attention paid to that. It got a lot of inches in newspapers. So why are we not adding that to the list?
Well, a couple of reasons. Again, I think so. From a purely scientific standpoint, it's a great result. And it's very important. It further nails down the age of the universe. In fact, it actually extends it a little bit in the sense that we used to think the universe was 13.7 billion years old. And now the Planck data suggests it's 13.82 billion years old. But again, to me, the Planck data, while certainly important, and this is very important in science, you have to have these incremental verifications of existing theories. To me, it wasn't like a huge leap forward. These other things I mentioned, like going from 2 seconds to 39 seconds with the quantum state, or coming up with a partial proof of the twin primes conjecture when there was nothing up until now for a century, or the first human-made object to actually physically leave the solar system. Those are things that are just so... they're just so much above the level of what Planck did in the sense of they're almost paradigm-shifting kind of things. Not quite, but, you know, they're almost that way.
Thank you to Ian Durham there. I think that was a very fitting choice for second place. It's shaping up to be an eclectic yet very well-informed list. There's been quantum physics, math, theory, experiment, and astronomy so far. And if you missed the early parts of the countdown, please visit the podcast page and listen to them. That's www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
We've also posted links with more information about the items on Ian's list, including past editions of the podcast, where we've spoken about some of them in more depth.
So, Ian Durham wants little green men. Well, how about this? Astronomer Abraham Loeb at Harvard University recently proposed that the early universe could have been hospitable for life to evolve. His astonishing calculations show that just 15 million years after the Big Bang, there could have been habitable planets. Ancient aliens could have lived and died in the universe's infancy. That's pretty mind-blowing.
And if that's not controversial enough, Loeb also claims that this theoretical finding calls into question the anthropic principle, which is often used to explain away the fact that certain physical parameters appear to be finely tuned to just the right values to allow life to evolve in our universe. The anthropic argument is well loved by proponents of multiverse theory, who believe many universes with different physical parameters exist alongside our own. They say that we shouldn't be surprised to find ourselves in one of the universes with parameters that are perfectly suited to allow us to exist because, well, we couldn't have found ourselves in one of the universes without the right parameters for life, could we? I spoke with Loeb and with Dean Ostumian a biophysicist at the University of Maine, about these provocative new claims and their implications for our understanding of the early universe, alien life, and multiverse theory. Could our universe have been teeming with alien life just 15 million years after the Big Bang? This startling possibility was recently raised by astronomer Abraham Loeb at Harvard University. Today, scientists including Loeb are searching for exoplanets orbiting distant stars that might be habitable. Their main criteria for habitability is that the planet lies at the right distance from its parent star, not too close and not too far, so that its temperature is just right for liquid water to exist. But Loeb has now calculated that the right level of heat for maintaining liquid water could have been provided in the early universe from a different source, the cosmic microwave background, the relic radiation left over after the Big Bang, which has slowly been cooling since the birth of the universe. Loeb stumbled on this intriguing possibility while calculating when the first stars and planets formed in cosmic history.
First of all, it's an interesting question to ask, when did life start in the universe? And I was surprised, actually, once I thought about this question, that it was not discussed much. And I wrote two books, actually, by now, on when did the first galaxies form. So I was capable of doing the calculation that figures out when perhaps the first stars formed within the observable volume of the universe. And a coincidence struck me that at the time when the very first objects formed, according to the standard cosmological model that everyone is using, around that time the microwave background had a temperature that is just a room temperature. That led me to the interesting insight that perhaps there was a habitable epoch during the early universe. And I was really surprised that nobody mentioned it anywhere and it was never discussed.
This means that there may have been a short window of time in cosmic history, lasting 2 to 3 million years, in which the cosmic microwave background acted as a heat bath, warming planets to the right temperature necessary for nurturing life, no matter how far the planet was located from a star.
In my childhood, I grew up in a farm, and I saw chicks hatch in an incubator. And the situation here is sort of similar. You put a uniform heat bath around a rocky planet and at the right temperature that would allow chemical reactions to take place in liquid water and life to develop. So the way I think of it is that the redshift of 100, the microwave background was just like an incubator. It didn't last for very long. This period of time lasted for 2 to 3 million years when the temperature was just right.
While the right temperature to maintain liquid water on a planet is a necessary condition for life to exist, it's not clear that it is sufficient for life to have evolved, admits Loeb. This sentiment is also echoed by biophysicist Dean Astumian at the University of Maine. He finds the claim made by Loeb in his recent paper intriguing, but urges us not to get too carried away.
Well, it's an interesting paper, but I think that the observation that complex chemistry is possible is very different than claiming that life is possible. I mean, certainly complex chemistry is necessary for life, but there are a lot of other things.
Astumian notes that while the conditions at this time may have been conducive to some forms of life, they would not be habitable for humans.
So, for example, if we were to all of a sudden materialize on a rock where the microwave background would keep us pleasantly warm, I don't think we would still be able to survive just because of that. So the conditions that are described in the paper by Loeb are certainly not what we would term habitable by us. So could some form of life evolve that would be able to remain? I have a hard time saying yes or no to that question.
While the conditions may not be suitable for life quite as we know it, says Astumian, science fiction fans may already be familiar with the kind of alien species that could thrive in such conditions. The Horta, a silicon-based life form from Star Trek, the original series.
Well, it was a silicon-based life form right? Silicon and boron have the ability to form, what, 3 bonds. Carbon has 4, and so you have a lot of complexity. But silicon and boron probably have enough to make a fairly complex and rich chemistry. And basically, they metabolize sulfuric acid. But there, it was entirely a rock-based life form, using as its energy high-energy rock, and it was converting it to lower-energy rock, and it lived underground, making caves. It didn't need light, so the absence of a star would not have been a problem, at least for its own evolution.
Star Trek's Horter aside, if correct, Loeb's calculations may have other far-reaching implications for our universe. In particular, it may call into question one of the strongest lines of argument used by proponents in support of the idea that our universe is just one of many in a multiverse of neighboring cosmoses. The multiverse is often invoked to explain why certain physical parameters in our universe seem to be perfectly tuned to allow life to have evolved. For instance, in the 1990s, astronomers discovered that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. Many believe that this acceleration is caused by an intrinsic energy of the vacuum, which pushes space apart. The value of this energy is given by the so-called cosmological constant, and must be tiny to give rise to the effects measured today. The strange thing is that according to particle physicists' calculations, this cosmological constant should be far larger, some 120 orders of magnitude bigger, in fact. But if the cosmological constant had taken on that huge predicted value, then matter would have been pulled apart before it could have clumped together to form galaxies, or our sun, or the Earth, or humans. Before the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe, Nobel laureate physicist Steven Weinberg argued that the cosmological constant must be small, because if it was large, we humans would simply not exist. This is an anthropic argument. Multiverse proponents use the anthropic principle to argue that the small value of the cosmological constant is evidence that other universes exist. They say that there are many universes, each with a different value of the cosmological constant. That means that other cosmoses do have the large cosmological constant predicted by particle physicists. But as humans, we were bound to find ourselves in one of the few universes with an unusually small cosmological constant, because that's the natural value that would give rise to human life. But Loeb's calculations threaten the validity of this argument. He says that his analysis shows that life could have been abundant in a universe with a cosmological constant that is a million times larger than the one we measure.
So the point is that at the age of 100, the universe was only 15 million years old. Very early on, it was about a tenth of a percent of the present age of the universe. So back then, the density of matter was very high. It was a million times bigger than the density of matter today. And so that led me to the other point, which is, in principle, life could have started, even if the cosmological constant was a million times larger, because once you make life, it may continue after that and evolve eventually into intelligent life. So a universe like our own could have led to life in it, even if the cosmological constant was much larger. That's the other point that they made.
Multiverse theory has been gaining popularity over recent years because it is also supported by ideas from string theory that suggest that multiple universes with different parameters could exist. But Loeb argues that his results mean that multiverse supporters should no longer claim that the value of the cosmological constant that we measure is the most natural one that is conducive for life to evolve.
In my mind, if life was possible, if the cosmological constant was much larger, then in my mind it argues that you can't just say that the natural value of the cosmological constant is the value that we observe, because there is a wide range of much bigger values that around. And actually, this range spans 6 orders of magnitude, so it's about 5% of the 120 orders of magnitude that we can envision all the way to the Planck density that string theory is talking about. I was just trying to bring up the point that you can't just say that the exact value that we observe is the natural one.
And then just philosophically, what's your gut feeling about the anthropic explanation for physics?
Yeah, so my problem with that is I think it's very dangerous. I think healthy science is done when people do not assume that they know the answer in advance and just test their ideas. And the problem with this culture is that even if you face them with tests, they always find a way to evade those tests. And frankly, at some point, it looks like philosophy to me, or like people that advocate intelligent design, or you can't really pin them down to a test that will eventually lead them to say, okay, we were wrong, let's move on to a different paradigm. In this paper, I was trying to be more modest and just point out that there is a range of 6 orders of magnitude that they should have considered when they argued that the cosmological constant has the value it has because it allows life to exist.
While Estumian agrees that Loeb has shown that life could have existed 15 million years after the Big Bang, he does not agree that this possibility violates the anthropic argument for the small value of the cosmological constant. He notes that the anthropic argument is based on the development of intelligent life, but since Loeb's habitable epoch only lasts for 2 to 3 million years, there is not enough time for intelligence to evolve.
And then he goes on to say that it argues against the anthropic explanation for the low value of the cosmological constant, and I do not see that that follows at all. So you could have a universe where you had a Big Bang, and for a few million years, you had the conditions somewhere with enough of the microwave background to develop something sort of like life, and then, well, it's gone. And, you know, going back to the anthropic principle of Weinberg, there what he's saying, at least partly, is that you would have to have a long time in which the conditions for life persist in order for intelligent life to develop. And that, I would agree with Weinberg, that would require the formation of galaxies and things like that.
Loeb, however, says that we should not be too quick to dismiss the possibility that intelligent life could have developed.
Once you make primitive forms of life, they can survive much later. There is a paper from 1999 that Dave Stevenson from Caltech wrote where he argued that rocky objects that are ejected from the early solar system could maintain life on them, even if they go very far away from the sun, by developing a blanket of molecular hydrogen atmosphere around them. And so one can imagine ways by which life will survive later on once it's made.
You know, the anthropic principle, the multiverse, these are quite controversial ideas, even, you know, within cosmology. And some people are very passionate adherents to that. And some people are really sort of, they sort of take the view that this isn't something that we can really test. This isn't something we can know. And perhaps it's not something that's worth devoting that much energy to. So in terms of the emails that you've been getting and the reaction that you've been getting, have you seen that kind of split?
Yes, I did. There was a very clear split. The people that in the past devoted a lot of time to the anthropic argument, that they're arguing with me, and they gave me the hardest time. I didn't get a hard time from an Earth scientist, for example. I mean, the most hostile messages were from people that invested time in the anthropic argument. So it shows something about the sociology of this field. By the way, it was easier for me to reply to those people because their arguments are not based on facts. If an Earth scientist would have come to me and said, you know, it took 200 million years for the Earth to cool, you don't have that time in the early universe, and he would present me with a set of arguments that make it much less plausible, I would have difficulties counteracting that. But
yeah.
When a string theorist comes with an anthropic argument talking about the measure of different parts of the multiverse and so forth, I don't have a problem with that. It's, in my mind, speculative.
Phew. Thank you to Avi Loeb and Dean Estumian there for bringing a bit of Star Trek to life for us.
You can read more about Loeb's ideas in an article that I wrote for Nature, which I've linked to on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. And that article also includes Freeman Dyson's thoughts on the matter, if you're interested.
You know, we just don't get enough sci-fi references into these podcasts. If only Ian Durham could work one more in for us. But I guess that would be too hard to contrive. What are the odds that the number one item on his list lends itself to an easy movie reference? Not high, I imagine. But anyway, this brings us to Ian Durham's top physics story of 2013. Drum roll, please.
Bum-ba-da-dum. This will probably give me away as being a child of the 70s and 80s. My number one for this year, and I'm purely biased because of just my childhood, is the discovery of photonic matter, meaning lightsabers. I wouldn't go quite that far, but this is pretty amazing. Some researchers at Harvard and MIT were able to make molecules of photons, which is just insane. How do you do that? Just wrapping your head around, how do you make something out of photon? Because photons are the quantum particle of light. It's hard to wrap your head around the fact that you could take two particles of light and actually get them to interact in some way. Because in the universe, there are four fundamental interactions: gravity, electromagnetism, the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. Each of those, in the standard model of particle physics, each of those interactions is mediated by what's called a boson. The way I usually tell my students, the boson is kind of like the mailman going back and forth between two fermions that are exchanging information. So the bosons are constantly going back and forth, shuttling information back and forth between these things. So the bosons are the mediators of the interactions. And it's not that we haven't seen other bosons interact in their own right, but how do you get two photons to actually interact? And if they do, what's the mediator? And what's the force or the interaction that's going on there that causes them to behave this way? It's a fascinating look. But then on the practical side, it's also interesting from the standpoint of maybe we can actually get lightsabers, and I could have a lightsaber. I could be a Jedi Knight. But I think from the foundation standpoint, it's a huge paradigm shift. It's a new state of matter. And there's going to have to be all sorts of theoretical work, I think, done to figure out what this means.
Well then, sorry to disappoint you, but while I was sort of looking through this, I guess officially they're saying that they haven't started to try to make lightsabers yet, although we don't know why not. But, you know, maybe that's just the official story. Maybe unofficially there's some kind of military lightsaber unit there. And maybe you'll get one soon, Ian.
I'm sure that there is a military lightsaber out there already. And yes, it's all apply for some DARPA funding. But yeah, oh well.
I don't think many would argue with you on your number one choice there. I think that was something that excited, even people, and there are such people, believe it or not, who aren't really that interested in foundational physics. So I think it's probably a good choice with a great wide appeal there.
That was another reason I picked it, because things like Voyager. Voyager inspires a lot of people, but there are also people who just shrug their shoulders and say, what good is it? What is it going to do? You know, that's a waste of taxpayer money, blah, 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 which, of course, I disagree with, but there are people who will say that. If you want to emphasize the importance, this is another area where Sean Carroll and I disagree a little bit. So he's of the opinion that we should get people to appreciate foundational work simply for its own purpose, and that foundational should be appreciated by the general public just for being foundational. While I agree that it should be, that we should appreciate foundational research simply because it's important for us as a species to ask these introspective questions, the reality is that we live in a world where increasingly science in general gets the short end of the stick in many respects, in the sense that even though we live in a highly technological society, we live in a society that increasingly can't understand that technology. And if you want to reach people and you want to emphasize the importance of these things, you have to cross over a little bit to their world and you have to appeal to them. And something like this, where you've got something that appeals to people who may not be into space stuff, may not be into adventure for its own sake, but they think, wow, a lightsaber. Holy cow, that is cool, right? Then you might actually get some people to say, oh, maybe there's some worth in this quantum stuff and this foundational stuff, and maybe all this studies of the universe might actually have a purpose.
So, there we have it. The top physics story of 2013 is the invention, kind of the Star Wars lightsaber.
You know, I don't think he really needed to say much more than that. That's something everyone would get excited about. And you see, I was right to call him Darth Durham. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then please go and download part one of the December podcast trilogy at www.fqxi.org/community/podcast and find out what that reference is all about. Download it right now.
You did indeed choose the right trilogy, Brendan, the first time round, though I'm not sure Ian will take kindly to being identified with Darth Vader.
Oh, we all turn to the dark side eventually.
On that ominous note, we will leave you and wish you a happy new year. Thank you to Avi Loeb and Dean Astumian.
And to Ian Skywalker Durham.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morales.